It's Tuesday, February 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, Syrian rebels suffer big losses. The road to the White House continues with a vote in New Hampshire. Global markets slide on oil again.
To detonate on a time device suggests a very sophisticated operation. It seems that we've been very lucky to avoid a much bigger disaster.
Investigators probe the explosion on a Somali airline. Also ahead, the Country Music Awards are upon us. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Syrian rebels have suffered heavy losses from Russian warplanes as refugees continue to stream out of the country to flee the violence. International Edition's Susan Yaki spoke with Jamie Detmer, who is at the Turkish border, for the latest.
I've spoken to several rebel commanders I've known for 3 or 4 years, who are pretty despondent. Many of them are talking about whether the Free Syrian Army, the Western-backed, more secular, less religious-based militias can hang on. Certainly some of the fighters I've spoken to, and I spoke to one last night, a 20-year-old who for a quarter of his life has been fighting. He withdrew after 4 days on the battlefront with about 100 others from a militia called Al-Zinki. They came under tremendous airstrikes. He said on the fourth day they were hit with 400 airstrikes, which is a lot. As well as that, they were being hit by all kinds of different ordnance, from cluster bombs to vacuum bombs to barrel bombs to missiles.
In your opinion, is this a turning point in the fighting, or is this a dip for the rebels that they may very well rebound from?
I think it could be a defining moment because I think one of the consequences of this could be that a number of these more moderate militias just implode. They've been having a very hard time, really, for about 6, 7, 8 months. They rallied in September and October when the military intervention started and put up a tremendous defense, although they still had to rely on some of the more hardliners in these militias and on the al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra to stem that original offensive in the autumn. But now they do seem to be in a lot of disarray. Again, they've had to appeal for help from Har al-Sham, which is a hardline Islamist brigade that was partly founded by al-Qaeda people, as well as Jabhat al-Nusra. So one of the things that several observers, analysts, and some of the fighters themselves say is that if we see a number of these militias implode, just disband, some of the fighters will join the bigger Islamist brigades, the more powerful ones, just for self-protection, if for no other reason.
Is there any sign that the coalition or anybody will be able to step in to replace these rebels that are leaving?
It's always been a hard problem in the last year or so to recruit. I remember in the summer a rebel commander saying to me that for every 10 fighters that he lost on the battlefield, he'd be lucky to get 4 to replace them. But then when the Russian intervention started in September, there seemed to be a rallying moment, and they were having no trouble in recruitment. But I think that, you know, certainly if the city of Aleppo is completely besieged, and it looks like de facto it is now, and if we see that area north, the north countryside, I think it will be hard to replace them. And I think that what may well happen is that the Free Syrian Army, the more moderate brigade, live to fight another day in the south. They're getting a lot of support from the Jordanians. But in the northern Syria region, I think they're going to have great trouble in recruiting. As I said, I think we'll see a resurgence of some of these more hardliners of Islamist militias. As a result, I think they're the ones who are going to be able to recruit.
As an eyewitness, what have you seen there along the border?
Well, not as much as I would like. In the way that the Turkish government isn't allowing the refugees in, it's not allowing Western reporters to cross the border into Syria to cover this. So we're covering it really at second hand from people who have illegally crossed the border, fighters and commanders and some civilians as well. Some of them are getting through the border by paying Turkish border guards up to $1,200 per person. Others are sneaking in with the help of smugglers. So we're hearing these accounts from them. We're not getting in. And that is, for me, deeply frustrating, and for my colleagues who are all milling around at the border gate trying to get permission to cross. So we're not seeing very much. We do hear bangs from where we are from time to time. Some heavy airstrikes are only about 20 kilometres away from the border and less. There's a lot of fighting, we know, from our sources.
Information tough to come by out of Syria. Our thanks to Jamie Detmer. Time for us now to check out what the latest trends are among the online community. Our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio to fill us in on what the U.S. presidential candidates are tweeting. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
Let's talk about the big kahunas today. Who do we have first?
Well, for a change, let's begin with the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton, as you know, runs a very prolific and savvy Twitter campaign. She has been sharing her day with her Twitter followers like other contenders. But unlike other contenders, she got her husband involved, who we all know as a former president, Bill Clinton.
That's right. Interesting. So how is he involved?
Through a photo sharing app called Instagram. Bill Clinton tweeted, "I am taking over Hillary's Instagram from New Hampshire today. Follow along." And he added a link to her page. The pictures were also shared on Twitter, but what's interesting is that Bill Clinton is also in it. So naturally, people are asking, so who took it? I'm guessing the staffers. Also, Clinton won some brownie points from Asian American voters by wishing everyone who celebrates a happy Lunar New Year. Bernie Sanders, her biggest rival, didn't do that.
Oh, what did Sanders have to say?
To come out and vote, basically. His staffers began using a new hashtag called #VoteTogether. He even posted a video of himself speaking in the snow, saying, "If there's a huge turnout tomorrow, I think we're going to win. I urge you all, come out and vote." And of course, ending the tweet with a new hashtag.
I see. And I have seen quite a negative back and forth between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush. Tell us a little bit about that.
It started out with Trump tweeting this. Jeb Bush has zero communication skills, so he spent a fortune of special interest money on a Super Bowl ad. He is a weak candidate. Bush replied, "Donald Trump, you aren't just a loser, you're a liar and a whiner. John McCain is a hero, over and out." And Trump sent out at least three tweets about Bush after that. Before I go, I briefly want to mention Marco Rubio, who was painfully situated between these two during the last two debates. Rubio sent out a brief Lunar New Year's message and a photo of himself at a diner in New Hampshire. That's all for me today.
Well, thank you so much for that update, G. You may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee or through our program's account at VOA_IE. I'm there as well at VOA Stevenson. The road to the White House continues with the New Hampshire primaries today as voters in that northeastern U.S. state select who they would like to see represent the Republican and Democrat parties for president in the national election this November. Climate change has been one issue among the Republican candidates who largely have discounted assertions that the world is warming because of human activity. One of the candidates, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, has an additional issue. His home is slowly being encroached by rising water, as we hear from Newsweek political correspondent Nina Burley.
That's right. He does have a problem. I went down there in early January, and I met with mayors of some of the 34 municipalities in the Miami area, including the mayor of Miami Beach and the mayor of Coral Gables, where, by the way, Jeb Bush also lives. And they are in panic mode. They are responding to sea level rise that has already begun to influence and affect the infrastructure in their community. Task forces have been set up to figure out what to do as the water comes up through the ground, where to move infrastructure, where to move hospitals, where to move roads. They're already talking about things like relocation of infrastructure and relocation of people as the sea level continues to rise. And incredibly, he's talked about how these things will destroy the economy. It's just really ironic to go down to Miami and see the effects of the water rising. I was there during January when they were having freak rainstorms. When it rains, the streets get filled with water. And in some places in Miami Beach, they even have fish swimming in the streets now.
Rubio's position and Jeb Bush's as well aren't too far from the Republican positions as a whole on climate change. They have been focused squarely on the economy and saying that, as you mentioned, that would hurt the economy. Ironically, when you're talking about relocating infrastructure, it would seem to me that in some sense that would be boosting a segment of the economy, as there would be a lot of work needed to be done.
Yes, that's true. And interestingly, back when he was in the Florida legislature, he made a speech in which he espoused the idea that Florida could become a leader in green energy, and that the challenge of dealing with sea level rise and of dealing with issues, you know, fossil fuels affecting the climate, could be something that the economy of that Florida became a leader on. I mean, I think he even used the words the Silicon Valley of green energy. And as soon as he started running for Senate, he stopped talking like that.
You know, therein lies the key. Tax revenue comes from property as opposed to income tax in Florida. And if Rubio's economy, if you will, is built around real estate, and there's a very real threat to real estate, he has an issue.
Right. Exactly. He does have an issue. Talking about it is not what's going to affect the economy. It's already going to be affected. After this article came out, I was emailed by some people on the Hill, and they said he signed on to a climate change resolution that Republicans are signing now in the House that two congressmen from Florida are spearheading. Even his Republican colleagues in Washington are beginning to step forward on this.
Nina Burley is national politics correspondent for Newsweek. Check out her article online, Marco Rubio, Climate Change Denier, South Florida Flood Crisis. Nina, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Global financial markets took another beating on Monday as oil prices continued to slide and drag down virtually all of the other sectors with it. VOA senior economics correspondent Jim Randall joins us with some of the reasons why oil alone seems to be having such a big impact on economies around the world.
Well, they seem to be in lockstep, which is unusual. But I think what's going on is that investors are looking at the price of oil as a proxy, as a barometer of economic demand. If there's a lot of economic demand, there's a lot of demand. If there's a lot of economic activity, there'll be a lot of energy demand, and the price of energy, including oil, would go up. When the price of oil goes down, they infer that economic activity is weak, and so it's going to be harder to sell things. It's going to be harder to make a profit, and they get worried, and they start dumping stocks.
The entire economy, of course, is not built on oil. There are other fundamentals to the economy, and does that perhaps ease investors' minds in the long run that we're not going to be so closely tied to this barometer?
Here you have oil is one. It's an important sector of the economy, but it's just a sector. There were something like 700,000 jobs in the U.S. oil industry. They've lost 100,000 jobs. That's a lot. Mm. Actually, they've lost more. It's actually even worse than that. But it's a lot. But there are 142 million jobs in the United States. So just to keep it in perspective, 100,000 jobs is a lot. But in percentage terms, not so much. These jobs tend to pay better than others. So they have a little bit more impact, but still, it's you know, it's not even 1% of the economy.
Oil, I presume, would be tied to the Chinese economy a little bit more because of the heavy manufacturing that it,
sure.
it's still, you know.
And that's an interesting question because advanced economies like the United States and some of the European countries are more efficient. For each dollar of GDP output, we use a bit less energy because our processes are more efficient. We've been working at it longer. And so to produce a dollar of GDP growth in China takes more energy. They're working on it. They're moving up the food chain. I mean, it's a very astute group of people, but they're not there yet. And they're, you know, it's an emerging economy. They still have work to do.
And, of course, the other volatility that we've seen in the Chinese economy has also had ripple effects around the world.
I think one of the things that's going on there is that when you read the financial press, there's a deep and very nearly universal skepticism of Chinese economic statistics. A lot of economists are very, very leery of that. They think that perhaps they're they're inflated, they're too optimistic. And so when it goes down a little bit, people think they may fear that actually the reality is they went down a lot. And so it seems to have a disproportionate impact on the for the amount of change going on in the Chinese markets, because there's a trust problem.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of dynamics in the oil market. Of course, you know, the Russians are highly affected by this. We see the Iranians now coming into the game because of the lifting of sanctions, and you even have other countries like Nigeria that are directly affected by this.
Sure, all the oil exporters are getting hurt price wise because previously OPEC and Saudi Arabia is an incredibly important member of OPEC. They would continue. They would pump oil when supplies were short, or they would refrain from pumping oil when prices were, from their point of view, bad. Well, they decided to stop doing that, and in part, it was a strategic decision. The point of the Saudi action was to lower oil prices to the point where it drove competitors out of business.
VOA's Jim Randall. Well, Somali authorities continue their investigation into what is now believed to have been a terrorist attempt to bring down a commercial jetliner last week after it took off from Mogadishu en route to Djibouti. One person believed to have been the suicide bomber was killed. Two others among the 74 passengers were injured. The plane was able to safely return to Mogadishu Airport Tuesday after it took off about 15 minutes earlier, despite a one-meter-sized hole blown through the fuselage by an apparent bomb. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab is suspected of being behind the bomb plot, but there has been no claim of responsibility. Terrorism expert Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University tells VOA's Victor Beatty, despite a series of ground losses, Al-Shabaab remains both resilient and capable of such attacks.
It appears that in Mogadishu Airport, they had several people on the ground. The video of the laptop being passed to the passenger who was sucked out of the hole, that passenger is believed to be an accomplice, and that laptop believed to be packed with TNT explosive and set to detonate on a timed device, suggests a very sophisticated operation. It seems that we've been very lucky to avoid a much bigger disaster. It appears that the aircraft being delayed in taking off, the timed device went off when the aircraft had not yet reached cruising altitude. It was only maybe 14,000 feet, and the resultant explosion, in the opinion of the pilot, at a higher altitude would have possibly caused damage to the fuel tank and the wing and caused the whole aircraft to be lost. So this is a horrible reminder that this group, Al-Shabaab, continues to be resilient, continues to be capable, and the Somali government is really struggling, along with the African Union forces. They're struggling to contain it. They haven't beaten it yet.
Greg, the pilot, when he returned, described security on the tarmac at the airfield in Mogadishu as very lax.
Yes, he's quoted as saying that when he parks the aircraft, dozens of people come on board, of course, wearing those high-visibility vests that suggest they're official, but they're not wearing official tags or identification badges, that it's impossible to know who's who, and, you know, anyone, frankly, can come on board and leave something behind for when the aircraft takes off next. So it sounds like a nightmare scenario. On the one hand, Mogadishu Airport is said to be very secure because of concerns about Shabab. Flights into the airport approach only over the ocean. They don't dare approach over the city because aircraft in the past have been shot at by small arms fire and landed with bullet holes. So on the one hand, they seem to be trying hard with security. On the other hand, they seem to have a major problem with airside security, where people are allowed on aircraft without proper vetting and check processes.
Laptops are relatively small, but can they actually house a bomb that can bring down an aircraft?
TNT is not the optimum explosive. The amount you can fit in even a large laptop is not optimum. We know with the Metrojet flight out of Sharm el-Sheikh that was, we think, brought down by Islamic State, they boasted of a device the size of a soft drink can. The key is where it's placed. Anyone attempting to do this would place it against the outside fuselage, the skin of the aircraft. The site that was chosen just ahead of the leading edge of the wing at the right point in time could indeed lead to a rupturing of the fuel tank.
Greg Barton says this latest terrorist attack appears to be a reflection of the infighting among rival al-Shabaab factions between those loyal to al-Qaeda and others to the Islamic State. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Academy of Country Music Awards, also known as the ACM Awards, is one of the most beloved ceremonies in country music. Recently, the organization announced its ACM nominations for this year's awards show, and it has many in the country music both surprised and disappointed. VOA's Music's Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to help fill us in.
So, Nikki, what are some of the surprises or snubs?
Okay, well, I think a great surprise is Joey and Rory. Now, their journey in the fight against cancer that they have so openly shared with us has had many of us riveted. It's touched our souls. It's inspired much of their music. So to see their work being acknowledged, even as Joey is in hospice, is very heartwarming. One of the snubs is that there's no more fan voting. So in the past, the ACMs would ask the fans to determine who would win the Entertainer and New Artist of the Year awards, but not anymore. Now it's only the industry and country fans voting for those categories is part of what made the ACMs distinctive and different from other award shows. So now country music fans are snubbed. So we're not part of that process anymore.
Well, I understand Blake Shelton wasn't nominated for anything.
I know, not one thing. This was really crazy. So Blake Shelton is the most high-profile country artist, number one. He is a consistent hit maker. He's always charting, and he's just one of country music's favorite vocalists. And he usually hosts the actual show.
Oh.
So this year, he's not hosting. Now, is there a connection there? I really don't think so. Some people have speculated that, you know, people don't appreciate that he dated Gwen Stefani so soon after his divorce from Miranda Lambert. I don't think that's the case as well, but I think it is fair to say that he could have at least been nominated for Male Vocalist of the Year. He has responded to the snub, and he said that he's just happy to have the night off for a change. He doesn't have to be there to win, and he doesn't have to be there to work. So
he doesn't have to get dressed up.
Exactly.
Well, how did the women fare?
Okay, now this is interesting. It's nice to see Jana Kramer and Kelsey Ballerini. They're relative newcomers, but they've both had chart success, and they are nominated in the category Female Vocalist of the Year. So that's nice to see. But one humongous disappointment were that there were no women nominated for Album of the Year. Now, this is crazy because both Kacey Musgraves' Pageant Material and Ashley Monroe's The Blade were highly regarded by critics. These are great projects. And both of them have been nominated for Grammys in this category, Best Country Album of the Year, but totally ignored by that category in the ACM. So that's really kind of crazy.
Well, speaking of Grammys, they're right around the corner. Any predictions?
I think Chris Stapleton is going to be a big winner. I hope Kacey Musgraves or Ashley Monroe snag one for Album of the Year. I hope. And it would be sweet, I think, if Joey and Rory win in Best Country Duo or Group Performance category. And it would be just in time for their new CD, Hymns, which will be released February 12th.
Thank you, Nikki. The Academy of Country Music Awards air live April 3rd at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on CBS. You can hear music from the aforementioned artists and more on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on social media at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA underscore music on Twitter. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
If I needed you, would you come to me? Would you come to me for to ease my pain? If you needed me, I would come to you. I would swim the sea for you.
Nikki Strong is really amazing. You should look her up on Twitter. She not only follows country music for us, but all kinds of other things as well. She's got quite an interesting stream out there. Ours is pretty good, too. We hope you follow us at VOA underscore IE. This, of course, is International Edition, which you've been listening to. You can also find us at voanews.com. Our engineer is Chaz Hall. Our director is Tracy Carter. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we thank you so much for joining us today. Come back and visit when you can, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, recently contributed $20 million to support the provision of food to approximately 1.2 million temporarily displaced persons of the federally administered tribal areas. 75,000 earthquake-affected individuals and 153,500 malnourished women and children in Pakistan. This new contribution by the United States will be managed by the United Nations World Food Program, or WFP, which will mill approximately 40,000 metric tons of wheat provided by the government of Pakistan into fortified wheat flour. In addition, the WFP will purchase and distribute more than 9,000 tons of specialized food commodities to these groups. USAID's $20 million donation is a contribution to the Twinning Program, a partnership among the government of Pakistan, the WFP, and the international donor community. Through the Twinning Program, wheat donated by the government of Pakistan is milled into fortified wheat flour and distributed to vulnerable displaced populations in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province and the federally administered tribal areas. Donor funds are used to cover the costs of milling, fortification, storage, transportation, and distribution of the flour. USAID is the largest international donor to the Twinning Program, and with this latest contribution has now reached $75 million in total support to the program since 2013. The U.S. government is helping Pakistan to improve access to safe and nutritious food for women, men, and children who are vulnerable to malnutrition, USAID Mission Director John Groark said. The United States has a long-standing commitment to working with Pakistan to provide humanitarian assistance and support human development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.